Welcome to the audio version of Obesity Panacea. I'm Travis Saunders, and today on the podcast, we have a debate titled Forks versus Feet. Now, this is an event we held at the University of Ottawa about a month ago, and it was organized by the Canadian Obesity Network Student and New Professionals Group at the university. So at this event, we had Dr. Bob Ross, who is the director of the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Queen's University, also my master's supervisor. He was arguing for the importance of exercise for weight maintenance and weight loss as well. And then Dr. Yoni Friedhoff, who is the medical director of the Bariatric Medical Institute in Ottawa and a very popular blogger, he was arguing for the importance of diet. So forks versus feet, the two of them had it out. It was a great event. We had about 150 people in attendance, another 80 that watched it live online, and we've had more than 600 watch it on the blog since then. So first up will be Zach Ferraro, representing the Canadian Obesity Network Student and New Professionals Group at the University of Ottawa. Following that will be Dr. Rachel Colley, who is our moderator for the event, and then will be Dr. Ross and Dr. Friedhoff. So just thanks to everyone who helped put on the event. Thanks also to Adrian Ebsery, who recorded the video of the event, which we've got up on the blog. And of course, thanks to our moderator, Rachel Colley, and our excellent debaters. So enjoy the debate. It's a bit of a longer episode than usual, probably about 70 minutes. So buckle in and enjoy.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for gathering here today for this debate. My name is Zach Froh, and I'm currently the chair of the National Executive for the Canadian Obesity Network Student New Professional Organization, PhD candidate in the Faculty of Health Science, working with the HALO group. For those of you who aren't familiar with CON, the Canadian Obesity Network is a non-for-profit organization that is designed to connect professionals, clinicians, researchers, people in industry who have an interest in the prevention and management of obesity. To date, we've connected over 6,000 members across Canada and the world, and the CON SNP group, the Student New Professional Group, is an umbrella organization from CON. And to date, we have over 1,500 active members who participate actively in knowledge translation and capacity building events such as this today. So this event has been very widely advertised, not only through posters, but through the internet. It's been advertised on blogs, Weighty Matters, Dr. Friedhoff, Obesity Panacea, from my friend and colleague Travis Saunders from the HALO group as well. For those of you who are not members of the Obesity Network, it's free to join. And there are many benefits of joining. You see one of us after, and we'll explain it to you. Sign up at www.obesitynetwork.ca. So without further ado, I would like to first introduce our moderator for the event, because since it is a heated debate, we thought it would be best to have a referee. Our moderator is a new professional herself, and it is Dr. Rachel Colley. She is a recent recipient of one of the Healthy Active Living and Obesity Junior Research Chairs at CHEO, which is funded by the CHEO Foundation and the Lawson Foundation. Dr. Colley completed her PhD in Australia in 2007 and joined the HALO team as a postdoctoral fellow in 2007. She brings expertise in applied physiology and specific skills relating to the measurement of energy expenditure and body composition. She is currently the scientific officer for the Healthy Active Kids Canada and led the writing of the report card in 2008, 2009, and 2010. She is the lead of the physical activity analysis team at Health Canada, Canadian Health Measures and Statistics area. She has recently initiated a new study investigating the influence of the interplay of fitness, motor skills, activity preference, self-efficacy, and physical activity, and healthy weight management in overweight children. So without further ado, our moderator, Dr. Colley.
Thank you very much, Zach. Can everyone hear me in the back? Sounds okay? Okay. So thanks very much for coming. It is my great honor and privilege to be here today to participate in this debate. I think it's a very exciting day for CON and the CON SNP group, and thanks to Zach and his team for putting this together. I think we're definitely lucky today, and I think it's going to be an entertaining show, to say the least. So just switch over here. So just wanted to introduce the topic a little bit. I don't think it's any shock or surprise to the audience here that we have an obesity epidemic in this country. Over half of Canadian adults are overweight or obese. About a quarter of children are overweight or obese and facing the same fate. So I think right now we have a crisis, but I think the impending crisis that's coming is something that we really need to be concerned about. So a few things just in the title of the debate that I'd like to draw your attention to before we start. So we're going to be looking at what is more critical between dietary intake and energy expenditure. So keep this more critical statement in your mind throughout the debate to try and ascertain which of the two debaters is doing a good job of arguing which one is the most critical. And then remember also what we're talking about, both treatment and prevention, because I think this has an impact on the debate and the question that we're asking. So to quickly go through the plan for today, this is the rough agenda. So we're just going through the introductory remarks now. There's going to be a coin toss to determine which of the two debaters is going to speak first. And then each will get 20 minutes to give their side of the argument. So we're talking about pro-exercise and pro-diet. Then we're going to switch to 5 minutes rebuttal to each of those first arguments. And then hopefully, without too much fist fighting and elbowing up here at the front, we'll come to a consensus summary by our two very distinguished speakers. And then we'll have hopefully time at the end for sure for question and answer. So I think before we get started, I really have to set the scene of who we have in front of us here today. So first off, for pro-exercise, Dr. Robert Ross, currently a professor of the School of Kinesiology and Health Studies in the Department of Medicine, Division of Endocrinology and Metabolism at Queen's University. Now, the presenters asked me not to give a formal introduction, but I'm going to go through and give a couple of highlights. So Dr. Robert Ross obtained a bachelor's degree in physical education from McGill. He then continued with a master's and PhD in exercise physiology at the University of Montreal. He has been the past president of the Canadian Society for Exercise Physiology, a fellow with the ACSM, and director of the Centre for Obesity Research and Education at Queen's, and was recently awarded a research chair at Queen's University. So Dr. Ross's research program, if you're not aware, focuses on the identification and management of obesity and related comorbid conditions. In recent years, his lab has conducted a number of randomized controlled trials to determine the efficacy of lifestyle-based interventions designed to reduce abdominal obesity and related health risk. I actually had the privilege of working with Dr. Ross way back in the day when I was attending Queen's University, and what intrigued me about Dr. Ross's work was his unwavering passion to investigate the impact of exercise on the body despite no change in the number on the scale. So I think we're really lucky to have Dr. Ross here to talk about his seminal work in this area. To give you a sense of some of the breadth of his work, I'm just going to read a couple of titles from key papers over the years. So exercise without weight loss is an effective strategy for obesity reduction in obese individuals with and without type 2 diabetes. Influence of diet and exercise on skeletal muscle and visceral adipose tissue in men. So it just gives you a bit of a flavor of the type of work that Dr. Ross is bringing to the table. So, secondly, for pro-diet, we have Dr. Yoni Friedhoff, and a totally different perspective here. We have a more clinical background in training. He's currently a family doctor in Ottawa and medical director of Ottawa's Bariatric Medical Institute. This is a multidisciplinary, ethical, evidence-based nutrition and weight management center. Dr. Friedhoff graduated with honors from the University of Toronto Medical School, but very early in his medical career, he realized that the medical community was not treating obesity in the most effective way that it possibly could, and also the training of medical doctors was not adequate. In March 2005, he became one of only three physicians in Canada to be board certified by the American Board of Bariatric Medicine. Dr. Friedhoff has been referred to as one of Canada's most outspoken obesity experts, and the Canadian Medical Association Journal once dubbed him as a Canadian nutritional watchdog. In 2010, Dr. Friedhoff helped to co-found Reality Coalition Canada, a non-profit group of diverse Canadian experts whose mission is to promote evidence-based obesity prevention and treatment policies and messages. Some of you may be aware of Dr. Friedhoff's thoughts and musings through reading his very entertaining and at times controversial blog called Weighty Matters. So with no further ado, I'd like to move forward with getting the debate off and running. So we're going to start with a coin toss. So if I could ask the two speakers to come up. I ask you to welcome the speakers to the floor. Okay, please welcome our pro-exercise debater, Dr. Robert Ross.
Okay.
You're this one?
Oh, yeah, okay. Do I have to project? Does that mean speak loud? Okay.
So you might want to pull this out and you can use your arrow there.
Okay.
To get ready.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much, Rachel, indeed. And thank God that was the abridged introduction. No minutes at all. But I'm indeed, it's an honor to be here today. I want to thank Zach, Travis, and Rachel, and all the SNP component of CON. It's indeed an honor to be here. And it's indeed a privilege to share the podium with Yoni. I'm a great admirer of Yoni's and the work that he does. And you can understand then it comes with a heavy heart that I have to defeat him badly here today, because unfortunately I have overwhelming evidence to say that it's all about the feet and nothing to do with the fork. Well, let me begin with something that we all know very much. As Rachel said, we have a problem. That's really not a surprise to us. But really, the question that I want to begin with, and I essentially have two, and this is the first one. We look at the increase that's happened over the last five decades, and we ask ourselves, in the context of today's discussion, what role nutrition or physical activity might play. And to put the question a little bit more specifically, I suppose I would ask the question, do trends in physical activity over the past 5 years relate in any way to concurrent changes in body weight in adults that we've seen over this time period? If the answer to that is yes, then I think we can say with some certainty that the feet play a role in the causation of the increase in obesity prevalence that we've seen. So very recently, I was very pleased to see, because this data is hard to get. This is the work of Dr. Tim Church. Dr. Tim Church works at the Pennington Research Institute in the United States. And of course, in the very brief time I have today, I can't give too many of the details of how he did it, but he's used the Department of Labor and the Bureau of Labor Statistics data that you can get there. This is solid data. It's not self-report. And basically, he made a couple of fundamental observations that I would like to share with you here. So if you look at occupational physical activity, which, of course, takes up an awful large part of your day, he and his colleagues made this observation. You can very clearly see here that if you look, and again, this is occupational activity, you can see very clearly over the 5 days, sedentary activity requiring less than two METs, or two times the resting equivalent, has increased. And light activity has increased dramatically over that time. But even more dramatic, we see a profound, almost 25% reduction in manufacturing-type jobs, which, of course, involve a great expenditure in physical activity. Now, this isn't planned activity, but this is activity, I dare say, contributes much more to the increase or decrease in your body weight than would the 30 minutes that you do in terms of following the guidelines. And basically, the upshot of what he found is basically this, that if you look over the five decades in both men and in women, you've seen a profound decrease in the occupational related energy expenditure, such that in men and women, this is the daily deficit that you've seen over this time period. Now, with this kind of information, you can predict weight gain. All else being equal, if this is the deficit that you see due to the decrease in physical activity, you can do something like this. And again, I can't provide the details. The reference is there for you. But this is what you can do. This happens to be in men. This would be the weight gain that you would see over the five decades. Now, if you parallel that with the actual weight increase that we've seen over that same time period. And this is weight derived from NHANES, for those of you unaware. This is a representative sample, a weighted sample of the United States. So we have two very good data sets here. And as you can see, just looking at the black bar and the white bar, almost all of the weight gain that we've seen over five decades is predicted by the decrease in occupational physical activity. And we see a parallel observation in the women. So this led Dr. Church and his colleagues to suggest that the daily decrease in occupational-related energy expenditure accounts for almost all of the increase in mean body weight for adult U.S. Men and women. Well, what about children? What do we know about the increase that we've seen in children, again, in the context of nutrition versus physical activity, which is Yoni and I's charge here today? So if we consider this question, what are the associations between obesity, physical activity, and dietary behaviors in children? And again, with respect to limited time that I have with you today, I want to share the work of a young Canadian investigator, Dr. Ian Janssen. And basically what he has done is use the kind of data that you would expect him to use as an epidemiologist to make the following observations. And the first couple are of no surprise to you. If you look at the odds ratio for overweight, these are all the countries. He did 34 countries, a very thorough analysis. Canada is right here. And basically what this says, if you're a school age child, the more you are physically active, the less the chance of you being overweight or obese. So that makes some sense to you. And in fact, considering other aspects of the behavior, and our chair, Dr. Colley, would be well aware of this type of work, if you look at TV viewing time as another behavior, say the other side of the coin of physical activity, in all of these countries, pretty much the case is clear, increased TV viewing time is also associated with increase in obesity. So what about nutrition? Well, remarkably enough, if you look at soft drink intake, for example, in these same school-aged children, you see very clearly no pattern here. There's no clear indication, at least in this study, that soft drink consumption has something to do with overweight and obesity. And in fact, somewhat paradoxically and very difficult to explain, if you look at sweet intake in this same group, the higher the sweet intake, the lower the obesity. So I think when you take that together, it's fairly profound, and the authors conclude same, that if you're thinking of the factors that are most responsible for the increase in obesity in children, it's about physical activity and decreasing television viewing time. Now, I spared no expense or time and sought the primary author of this paper out for a personal communication, and I asked him what he thought about this, and he very clearly said, well, exercise is good, diet not so much. I may have paraphrased him just a little bit, but that's the gist of what I say. So with respect to the first question, if we look at the prevention, or what are factors, feet versus fork, that explain the profound increase in obesity that we see in adults and children, Madam Chair, I think it's very clear. It's about the feet, not the fork, I think is clearly what the data would say. Well, in the time that I have, I thought I'd look at two questions. As I said, here's my second question. If physical activity is responsible for the increase in obesity, well, then where's the evidence to suggest that if we increase physical activity, that we will decrease obesity, one following the other? So it made sense for me to consider this question, and so I did. Now, I need to be fair to my colleague, and I need to acknowledge that there have been several meta-analyses that looked at this. And here you have the loss in kilograms of either in the green weight or in red, the fat loss. And you can very clearly see here that at first glance, I look like I'm in big trouble here, because if you diet-induce if you calorically restrict, you get substantial weight and fat loss. And if you exercise, so here there's no exercise, here there's no diet, you get clearly a very significant reduction by comparison, or a lower reduction in adiposity by compared to diet. And sure enough, the next year, a group of outstanding colleagues reviewed the literature and made a similar observation. Said that if you look at aerobic exercise, and again, this is without the benefit of caloric restriction, as well as you can do that in reviewed literature, you get very modest exercise-induced weight loss and very modest exercise reduction in abdominal fat. So at first glance, it seemed that there's just something magical going on. You calorically restrict and you lose weight, but you exercise all day and just somehow the body just doesn't get it, doesn't understand, the negative energy balance doesn't matter. Well, this didn't make sense to us a few years ago, so we started to investigate this a little bit in our own group. And what we observed is this. True enough, two very important points. If you look at the energy expenditure in kilocalories per week, all right, and this is you can derive that from the literature. These are studies in which we could derive that. Now, this is exercise-induced negative energy balance. There's no caloric restriction here. And if you look at the reduction in kilograms in both weight and or fat, you very clearly see a dose response here. Now, because most of the studies had very low negative energy balance, the weight loss was very low. So what I was saying is when we were comparing nutrition or caloric negative energy balance to the increase in physical activity, we didn't have a level playing field. We had a 400 or 500 kilocalorie a day caloric restriction and maybe 100 calories from exercise. And then we say, well, look, see, exercise doesn't work. Well, we had a slightly different view. What we said was that if you calculated the expected weight loss, you got exactly what the program prescribed. So basically the problem was in prior reviews was they just didn't observe the literature or consider the literature the same way we did. What we asked then was this question. What if you take a person and you equilibrate the negative energy balance from diet-induced or the increase in physical activity energy expenditure from exercise? This is essentially the question that Yoni and I have to debate today. Looked at it pictorially, it would be basically this. If we have a 5 to 10% weight loss just through caloric restriction compared to 5 to 10% just to exercise, here's our question of the day. This is what we want to know. Are there treatment differences? Now we've leveled the playing field, and now we can analyze the question. Before, we had apples and oranges. Excuse the pun. All right. The second thing we have to do is look at outcomes. What are our desired outcomes? How are we going to determine treatment difference? Well, I submit to you that if we're going to compare the two, then we're going to look to see what happens to total fat. We're going to look to see what happens to abdominal subcutaneous visceral fat waist circumference. Lean tissue is very important tissue to conserve in terms of obesity management. We certainly want to improve functional capacity or cardiorespiratory fitness. This has to be a product of any treatment strategy to reduce obesity. And of course, then we want to reduce the comorbidities. And I'm just going to pick on one because I don't have much time. That's insulin resistance. So these studies have to be performed, and performed they were. And now we have diet-induced weight loss compared to exercise-induced weight loss, and we calibrate the negative energy balance induced by both of these. And then we have another group that exercises as much as this group, but we refeed this group. And as I always like to say, this is not a very popular group in our studies at all, but it does provide some insight for us. And they did all the kinds of things that you would expect them to do in this type of study. So now we have a level playing field. The first observation we see is now, well, if you equate the negative energy balance, you get the same weight loss. That was not what the meta-analyses were saying. They were saying that this exercise should have been up here, right? But all we did now is we prescribed the same basic treatment for both groups. And what do we see? Well, the first observation is that we have an improvement in cardiorespiratory fitness. And as you know, if you listen to me or any other exercise scientist, and most of you in here know, that's a primary outcome. I know they're engaged in the management of obesity, but now you've improved their functional capacity. So it's a no-brainer to say if you're not physically active, if you diet, there's no improvement in cardiorespiratory fitness. If you do exercise, there is, and that's important. Because as Dr. Blair has said for many years, these two groups have the same BMI, already we're managing obesity. We've managed obesity because we have someone who's obese and fit, and these person are doing 30 minutes most days of the week, and they've actually reduced their risk of cardiovascular disease mortality. We don't make enough of that as in our management of obesity. So that's coming as a result of physical activity, not as a result of caloric restriction. For the sake of time, I'll continue on. So what do we see with respect to total body fat? And these were some of the first observations, and they've been repeated since. I show you my work because it's obviously the stuff I know, but this has been repeated. We did predict that even though these two groups lost the same amount of weight, that there would be a greater mobilization of energy, and if I had time, I could tell you why, in both men and women. So not only now did you have the equivalent weight loss, but if our target is obesity reduction, feet gives you more than four. And in fact, as we showed in these studies in the exercise without weight loss group in both men and women, we also saw obviously substantially less a reduction in adiposity. If we look at abdominal obesity, again, I'm looking at this because this is a desired outcome. That's what you've come here to hear about. If we want to manage obesity, we've got to do something about abdominal obesity. And I'm just going to show you women now. Sorry for the acronyms, diet weight loss, exercise weight loss, exercise without weight loss. And although exercise, the gold star, exercise-induced weight loss, was substantively greater in terms of reduction of abdominal obesity than diet-induced weight loss, although we certainly don't want to dismiss this, exercise-induced weight loss, in fact, these women lost as much abdominal obesity, exercise without weight loss, as the diet-induced weight loss. So this was a very important observation, if we had more time, about how this can empower women who need such when they engage in behavior change. These are very important. And of course, in terms of visceral fat, we saw the same thing. So let me be clear. Diet-induced weight loss, negative energy balance, you're going to reduce. You equate that negative energy balance, exercise weight loss will win every day if you have the same negative energy balance. And of course, the reason we can see that is because there's an increase or a preservation of lean mass, whereas in diet-induced weight loss, there's a well-known reduction in lean mass because there's absolutely no stimulus to maintain it. You decrease weight, you decrease muscle, you decrease functional capacity. That would be my argument. In terms of insulin resistance, what do we know? If we look at acute exercise, I teach the exercise scientists in the room absolutely nothing. After one day of physical activity, this is physical activity-induced improvement in your ability to manage blood sugar. This is very profound. And as I do most of the time when I have the opportunity to show this, I ask my clinical colleagues, find me a medication that will give you this kind of outcome. So when we're talking to someone about the benefits of physical activity for managing obesity and related comorbidities, and they ask you, how long will it take before I see benefit? One day. You see benefit one day. Now, some of you may not believe that, may say that's impossible. Insulin resistance takes years. How do we improve that? Well, I apologize for this slide and its complexity, and I thank Lori Goodyear from Boston for sharing it with me. This mechanism of exercise or contraction-induced glucose uptake is unfolding, and it hasn't been, as I understand it, perfectly described yet. But here's the important point for me. This is an intact, weight-independent mechanism. What a glorious observation, right? You have someone with obesity, glucose intolerant, perhaps insulin resistant, and you have a mechanism to improve that outcome with physical activity one day, and you haven't done a thing about abdominal obesity or total obesity. Now, if you might ask the question, well, what if someone is silly enough to exercise more than one day? Right? Now we're going to sum these kinds of things. Well, then we've got to get into this type of observation right here. This is exercise. There is diet-induced, but the diet-induced improvement in insulin sensitivity could be comparable. I would give Yoni that. That would be comparable, right? You reduce caloric intake, you lose body fat, you will improve your ability to manage a major comorbidity. That's absolutely certain. But this is not the whole story, right? It's not the whole story at all. If you look here, we measure insulin sensitivity 4 days after the last exercise session. Why do we do that? Because the editors of journals give us the prior observation. They say, we already know that acute exercise is one of the best things you could do on planet Earth. Right? So you've got to get rid of that. You've got to take out that benefit and show me the chronic effects of exercise. So the chronic effects of exercise are mediated by the reduction in total and abdominal fat. And if you believe the data that I just showed you, just by that mechanism alone, exercise-induced weight loss would provide a benefit because we had profound reductions in abdominal obesity by comparison to equivalent diet-induced. But what we really should be doing is adding this. But we don't in these studies. So in all of these studies, I implore you to look at these studies where we have to wait, and we have to wait for the attenuation of the acute effect of exercise, because this is the truth. If you would have measured them after the last, they would have had the benefit of the adipose tissue reduction, abdominal or otherwise, and changes going on in the muscle. So you have mediation of improvement by exercise in the muscle. You have improvements by profound reduction in exercise, abdominal obesity. It's win-win. You can't lose. You cannot lose with exercise as a treatment strategy. So by way of a summary, Madam Chair, I've just got 2 minutes here. If you compare the two and you ask yourself, well, to the question that we have charged with today, assuming a balanced diet composition, similar weight loss, is there differences? Who gets the gold star, caloric restriction or exercise? Well, clearly it's exercise. The reduction in abdominal obesity, again, clearly exercise. Maintenance or increase of lean mass. My goodness, this is a massacre, Madam Chair. This is unbelievable. Improvements in cardiorespiratory fitness. It's not even close. And reduction in comorbidities, insulin resistance. Of course, we see that exercise wins. So I thought I might conclude this section by recognizing one of the world's foremost nutritionists. Jean Maillet passed away in 1993, known by most as the father of nutrition in the United States. The USDA Department of Nutrition Center for Study of Nutrition at Tufts University is named in his honor. And rather than take my advice in terms of what's more important, I thought I would remind you of the musings of Dr. Maillet when he says the following: adaption to modern conditions without development of obesity implies that a person will either have to step up their activity or endure mild hunger all their life. If the first alternative, stepping up activity, is difficult, it is well remembered that the second alternative, lifetime hunger, is so much more difficult that to rely on it for weight control can only continue the fiascos of the past. Now, that would be insightful in the year 2011. And I remind you, this is a nutritionist, the godfather of nutrition. But Dr. Maillet said that in 1955, and we have failed to learn. So by way of conclusion, dear Yoni, the evidence is clear. Admit defeat. Forget the fork and move the feet. Thank you very much.
I just want to thank Dr. Ross for that very insightful presentation. A couple of key points that I picked up from that. I want to thank Dr. Ross, first of all, for covering both prevention and treatment of obesity. And I also would like to thank Dr. Ross for talking about leveling the playing field, because that's a really important distinction. We often compare diet and exercise in unfair conditions. So when matched calorie for calorie, I think he's shown us that exercise can have the same impact as dietary restriction on reducing body weight. And I'd also like to thank Dr. Ross for talking about managing obesity and some of the other implications of dietary restriction and exercise. So when we exercise, we maintain muscle mass and we increase fitness. When we reduce caloric intake, he talked about the potential reduction in muscle mass and implications for resting metabolic rate. So thank you very much, Dr. Ross, and we'll move on now to Dr. Yoni Friedhoff, who's going to take us through the other side of the coin.
Thanks very much. That was a great talk, of course. I didn't expect any less. I want to thank Con, of course, for inviting both of us to come and chat today. I think it should be fun. And I think that, to an extent, what we're seeing today is going to be a discussion that compares bench to bedside. And I think that Bob's done a wonderful job of talking about benches. And I'd like to spend a little bit of time on bedside. Now, I've got one question before I start the actual formal lecture. What's the snack? I didn't see what the snack was. But given this is...
Sandwiches
and cookies. Okay, good. Okay, now before I get into this, you guys will have to endure me for the next, you know, half hour, 40 minutes. I want to just briefly talk about someone who's endured me for a decade. This is my wife. She's here today. It's our anniversary. This picture was taken 9 years ago today. And I want to thank her for sticking with me for 9 years. I don't understand why she has. But I love her dearly. And 9 years later, we've got these folks to be proud of. Okay. Okay, so I gotta un-tear up and then I've got to talk. So the first thing I want to talk about are what I feel are some truths. And I think that Bob actually has done a fabulous job talking about this first truth that I'm going to present. And that is that exercise is no doubt in my mind, and I think no doubt in the medical literature's mind as well, the single most important modifiable determinant of health. I do think that exercise, as far as health benefits goes, outweigh diet. However, that's not what we're here to talk about today. Today we're here to talk about the impact of exercise on weight control. And I also don't want to debate something else, and I think Bob made this very clear too. I don't think there is a debate that the laws of thermodynamics actually exist. If a person controls their calories through diet to a certain degree or exercises to a certain degree such that the deficit is the same calorically, I would expect there to be the exact same impact on the scale. And Bob's very seminal study on this subject has proven that to be true. And when I get to the slide of that study later on in this talk, I'll just skip through it since Bob's done such a good job. And this is the one I think that people may agree or disagree with, but I do think that this is true, that exercise, or the lack of exercise, is not the cause of our current obesity epidemic. And I also don't think it's going to be its cure. And so that's what I'd like to talk about today. And I want to start off with what I would describe as dearly held myths. And my daughters would find this very dear. But I want to talk about them because there are a few of them that I think are pertinent, especially to the audience that's here today. And the first myth, if all of my stuff works, is that when we were kids, we used to play outside matters. And that what has happened over the course of years is that we've seen shifts from this type of behavior in our children to these types of behavior in our children, although she scares me a little bit. In terms of this, I want to talk about the impact of screen time on weight, because Bob very clearly showed that wonderful slide of how screen time does correlate with weight. And so this was a particular study done in Greece looking at 2,400 kids between the ages of 1 and 5. And what they did find, absolutely, was that the kids who watched the most television were, in fact, the heaviest. The problem with then concluding that, therefore, not moving is causing this increase in weight is the fact that the relationship that they found, and this is found in many of the studies looking at screen time in children, persisted even after physical activity was controlled for. Meaning that, yes, there's no question, watching TV did increase body weight in these kids, but not as a consequence of decreasing their physical activity levels, because there was no difference when that was controlled for. In terms of video games, I think many people here are familiar with this study because it recently came out, actually today I think it was published in print, by Canadian J.P. Chaput, and it was looking at video games, one of the screen time components. And what it found was that video games weren't impacting on feet. Video games are impacting on forks. And how it's impacting on forks is, I'm not sure. This particular study looked at 22 adolescent kids. They gave them an hour of playing video games versus an hour of rest followed by eat as much lunch as you want. And the kids who played video games were consuming an extra 163 calories per day in this study. And so it seems that there is some mechanism by which video game playing and screen time is actually impacting forks rather than feet. But what if there was studies that proved that in fact there was a really marked decline in energy expenditure in kids? I guess the question then becomes, would increasing that help? And again, I'm not talking about the bench. I'm talking about free-living folks, because really that's who we're dealing with in the most part. And so this was a study done in Britain looking at 300 kids between the ages of 5 and 8 from 54 different schools for 4 years. What they found was interesting, that there was no association in this study between exercise and weight or body fat percentage, despite a tenfold difference in physical activity. So the kids who were 10 times as active had no protection against changes in their body weight or their body fat percentage over that 4-year period of time. I want to go to the second myth. Gym class. That one of the things that has dramatically contributed to the decline in, or the increase, I'm sorry, in weight over time has been the loss of gym class. And gym class is interesting. There was this beautiful study about, I'm sorry about all the words, I'll summarize it, where researchers called something an activity stat. They studied 3 different schools. They used accelerometers to get good data. They looked at kids in a prep school that got 9 hours a week of phys ed classes. It was a fancy schmancy school. Then they looked at a public school that had received an award of distinction for their dedication to physical activity, and the kids in that school were getting 2.2 hours a week of exercise. The last school they looked at was an inner city school that had no formal exercise equipment or facilities, and the kids there got 1.8 hours of weekly physical activity. What was fascinating in the study was that with the accelerometry data, there was no difference between the amount of exercise these kids did, regardless of which school they went to. And so the researchers came up with this term called the activity stat, where they postulated that kids are going to get a certain amount of exercise. If they do it all at school, they'll do less at home. If they do nothing at school, they're going to do more at home. And whether that's in the form of NEAT-type exercise, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, and they're moving more, and they're fidgeting more, and they're pacing more, who knows? But what they did not find was that a difference of schools with 9 hours a week of physical activity, which is a tremendous amount compared to those with 1.8 and no facilities, that's a surprising result. In terms of, is it really surprising? Well, maybe it's not as surprising as all that. So this was a study looking at 18 clinical trials with durations between 6 months and 3 years. They looked at over 18,000 students. This is a Canadian. I think I've got the reference on the next page. But looking at the impact of school-based phys ed programs on children's obesity rates. And as you might imagine, given who's talking right now, there was no difference. And it led the authors to conclude that while physical activity is crucial and should be promoted in our schools, that school-based physical activity interventions do not improve body composition. And go to myth number 3. Myth number 3 is that we've all become lazy. We're going to adults now. That we're no longer physically active. And I don't really know what that picture is. But perhaps my favorite picture is this last one. But we're not physically active anymore, and as a consequence of us being extremely lazy, that we need help to do everything, that somehow this is causing us to gain weight. This is the cause. And I think Bob laid out a case for a decline in physical activity to be the cause of our obesity rates. I found different studies than Bob did. This was a study looking at 22 different years of energy expenditure studies in MassDRIDE in North America between 1983 and 2005. During that same time period in Holland, obesity rates rose by 50% and 100% in the United States. And in terms of energy expenditure or physical activity levels, they were looked at as well. In terms of the results, what they found was, I think, actually surprising. I didn't expect these results when I started reading the paper. But that energy expenditure in Europe and North America, according to the doubly labeled water experiments, hasn't changed. It hasn't changed between the 80s and 2005. They found that the energy expenditure in our modern society with escalators and dishwashers, etc., are the same as we would find in the third world, where we would expect people, all that labor saving that Bob was talking about, the 140 calories for men and the 120 calories for women was going to make a difference. And that reduced energy expenditure due to lowered physical activity was unlikely to have fueled the obesity epidemic. And so in terms of blaming the escalator, this was a fascinating study as well, looking at a comparison between rural Nigerian subsistence farming women and urban Chicago women. And they were measuring total energy expenditure and resting energy expenditure to infer exercise, so they didn't use doubly labeled water here. And they followed the women for 3 years. The average weight of a woman in Nigeria was 128 pounds, and the average weight of a woman in urban Chicago was 184 pounds. There was no difference in energy expenditure. None. And more importantly, I think, there was no measure of energy expenditure that they found that was associated with weight change in either group for the 3 years that were studied. So again, there was no relationship between how many hours or how much activity these women did, whether it was in Nigeria or in Chicago or in urban Chicago for 3 years. And so, you know, you've got to wonder, was that just an anomaly? Was it a weird group of people? Was it a small sample size? Because it's such a strange result. There was a massive meta-analysis of doubly labeled water studies, 183 different cohorts, 5,000 subjects almost. They included studies from 14 countries that had low or middle human development indexes. So these, again, were the countries where we would not expect labor-saving devices to be a prominent part of society. And when they looked at the results, well, again, the total energy expenditure that adjusted for weight and age or physical activity level didn't differ. And again, the authors conclude that it calls into question the role of energy expenditure in the cause of obesity at the population-based level. The fourth myth. We're going to be able to exercise it off, whether it's the shake weight or discoing with Richard Simmons, that, you know, put aside everything I've just said, we can fix this problem with exercise. Regardless of whether or not it was or wasn't exercise that got us here, exercise will get us gone. It's not a myth. So this is the paper I'll skip over from Bob. You can exercise your weight away. He proved it very clearly. The problem is that we're talking about the real world. We're talking about the bedside. People don't diarize like they did in Bob's studies in terms of food diaries and keeping track of exercise. People do not, as a general rule in society, understand energy balance. And to an extent, I think they've been duped by public health messaging that says exercise is the bigger player or an equal player. Exercise in larger quantities may have some impacts too, may lead people to be hungry. They might compensatorily overeat, either because of hunger or because they feel they've earned it. I know that I often feel I've earned my seconds and thirds if I'm training and did a long run, but I know that the calories I can consume in 3 minutes are likely going to exceed all of the calories I burned in my exercise. And especially given that we do not provide this message as a general rule to society, I think that's what we tend to see. And time, of course, is very precious. We live in a very hectic world. And Bob's study had an hour of exercise daily to hit the 700-calorie burn. And I think it'd be wonderful if we could get people exercising an hour daily, but we haven't been able to do that ever. And so, in terms of the real world, the Dotenkamp study looked at 5,000 Dutch adults for 10 years. And they looked at their weight, waist circumference as a function, again, of their physical activity levels. Measurements at baseline in 10 years were done, but they also did something a little bit interesting. They asked a question, did you markedly increase your exercise during this time period? So they were studying whether people who started exercising more during the study protected themselves. They did not find any relationship with a single measurement at 5 years. But if they reanalyzed it, looking at that question, did you markedly increase your exercise? They did find a relationship with weight at 5 years. Sadly, that relationship disappeared at 10. And people who reported this marked increase in energy over the decade, they weighed 1.2 pounds less, and they had a 1/5 of an inch smaller waist circumference at the end of that 10-year period of time. The Nurses' Health Study, 34,000 women were monitored for 13 years. The 13%, there were 13% who did not gain weight over the course of that 10-year period of time. They started at a healthy weight, and they reported exercising an hour or more a day. There was no amount of exercise that was able to stop weight gain in the women who began this study already overweight. The APPEAL study, 196 obese folks were asked to exercise for an hour a day, 6 days a week, for a year. They were explicitly told not to make any dietary changes. And God knows how, but the researchers were able to inspire the men on average to exercise 6.16 hours and the women 4.9 hours a week. So this is the exercise-only intervention for a year with a tremendous amount of exercise. And they did lose weight. Over the course of the year, the men lost 3.5 pounds and the women 2.6 pounds. It was a dose-dependent relationship, if you look at it. So, for every 91.5 hours a year that exercise occurred by these participants, they lost 1 pound. This result was actually confirmed again indirectly by this Amish study. So this is looking at the FTO gene, one of the genes we know is associated in obesity. They looked at 705 Amish folks, and they found that the Amish who were active for 3 to 4 hours more a day than their sedentary FTO counterpart containing Amish friend or brother were in fact 15 pounds lighter. And in that case, it was an 85 hour of exercise a year to affect that 1 pound difference. So slightly better than the 91.5 hours in the other study, but pretty darn close. So life's not fair. It's really not fair because exercise is essential, it seems, for weight maintenance. So studies on weight maintenance seem to very clearly state that if you don't exercise, you are far more likely to gain weight. And whoever said that life was fair? 201 women randomized to one of four exercise arms with identical diets followed for 2 years. Very simply put, the folks who exercised more were more likely to maintain a 10% weight loss with identical diets. So it works. Look, aha, not so fast. The folks who exercised the most burned on average 163 more calories a day than those exercising the least. And it wasn't enough exercise calorically to explain this difference. If you analyze the data a little bit further and you look at the dietary reports, the folks exercising the most were eating on average 444 fewer calories a day than the folks who were exercising the least. What they found was the folks exercising the most had much better eating behaviors. And if you think about it differently, the magnitude of their dietary intervention calorically, because we don't want to argue that thermodynamic rules don't apply to people, they had a threefold impact with their dietary behaviors versus their exercise behaviors. So what's the true role of exercise in weight management? It's crucial. Absolutely crucial. We have it as part of our program in my office. I would not for a moment say it wasn't. It helps to moderate intake. It improves sleep. It cultivates an attitude of healthy living. It improves comorbid conditions, which in turn may impact on weight. It provides a functional caloric buffer. It does burn calories. I have worries, though. I have big worries about the role of exercise in weight management. And it's more about messaging than it is about fact. There's only so many dollars in the obesity research pot. I worry about interventions and studies being done purely looking at exercise without touching diet, given what we tend to see as real-world results on exercise. Public health messaging tends to ignore intake, especially with kids. We don't talk about intake. And I think as a consequence, we misinform choice. We are not providing a level playing field like Bob suggested we should. Exercise-based public health interventions designed to address obesity fail to promote the unbelievable benefits of exercise. That's why we should be promoting exercise. It is the most healthy thing we can do. But it is unlikely in the real world to have dramatic impacts on weight. And exercise-based obesity interventions, I think, risk being canceled when they don't yield dramatic results. So let's say we did get phys ed classes back in the schools, but somebody's studying whether or not it impacted on obesity rates in the kids, and it didn't. Well, that'd be a good reason to pull it back out of the school. But on the other hand, if we focus on other things that we can measure, as Bob was talking about, insulin resistance, blood pressure, you name it, visceral fat reduction, there's a lot of things that exercise will do. We'll lose those benefits. So why is there so much obesity? Well, so I have a different theory in terms of why there's so much obesity. Mine's food. This study looked at the energy gap in terms of what was being consumed by Canadians in 1976 versus 2003. There was an 18% increase in calories consumed. It's basically a meal worth. We're eating four meals a day, not three meals a day. Eat another meal a day, you're going to gain weight. And this was confirmed in America as well, looking at energy intake data from 1970. And they said that for adults, we're consuming 500 more calories, kids 350 more calories, and in turn, that explains things. You know, looking at the exercise that we're not getting in our jobs anymore is not the whole picture of exercise. People do other things. And whether adults have the activity stats or not, I'm not sure. But it's hard to look at exercise in the workplace as Bob presented it and extrapolate it to your total energy expenditure. We just don't know. Whereas here, we're talking about total energy consumption. And it does seem very clear that it will explain things. And why? Well, there's this wonderful series of slides that you can look at that look at whether or not what we're eating nowadays. And we're eating awful food. These aren't bad people. They're not trying to harm their kids. I did a piece with the CBC on a family here in Ottawa, and it was amazing what they were consuming. We're being duped by a food industry that spends 170 times more money today than it did in the 70s to sell food. They wouldn't be spending that if it didn't work. We've been supersized. We're eating a lot more. Food is everywhere. Ads for food have skyrocketed. Calories are dirt cheap. And I think if food's the cause, given the data on exercise, it's going to be up to food to be the solution. So the solution, what is it? Well, it's not actual dieting. We need to get away from the concepts of under-eating and over-exercising. I think it's thoughtful dietary reduction, bolstered by physical activity. It's far easier to not eat 500 calories a day than to burn it, but maybe burning 1 to 200 calories a day by means of intentional, reasonable, achievable exercise will help bolster better healthy eating behaviors. I just don't think you can out-train a bad diet. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Friedhoff. So again, we've got a few very good insights, a few key things that we heard in this last 20 minutes, some discussion about the free living world and the implications of that and obesity. I think Dr. Friedhoff did a really good job of talking about the real world experience with weight management. He also raised some other issues that are really important with obesity management, compensation behaviors. So do people change their behaviors when you restrict their diet or you increase their exercise? He also raised the idea of weight maintenance. So what about, there's weight loss is one thing, but keeping off that weight loss is another thing. And then finished off with some really key messages about how we educate the public and how we message information. So now we're going to give a few minutes to each of the speakers to have a little bit of a rebuttal to what they heard from the other speaker. So we're trying to keep this to about 3 to 5 minutes.
Okay, would we do a summary at the same time?
Yeah, so.
You want to just, I'll do the little rebuttal and then my summary, and then you can just finish with your summary?
and rebuttal?
Yeah, I don't have much rebuttal.
Okay.
Okay, so we'll have a combined rebuttal and summary, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, and well done, Yoni. As always, a very insightful presentation. Although I was somewhat concerned because I was actually thinking you were going to present some data in your presentation that actually showed the benefits of caloric restriction to sustain weight loss long term. I actually didn't see any of that data, so we'll have to wait. Perhaps it comes in your summary. I guess I do escape, and then... No, I think I can this, and then this, and then this. Okay, yes. Yes, of course. Yeah, just two or three points. When you're a hammer, everything tends to look like a nail, as we say. So I might be selective in what I heard Yoni say today. But here are two or three things that I said. Now, I'd like to begin by lodging a bit of a grievance. I'm not so sure starting off by saying I'm coming in here on my anniversary and my wife's here and my three kids. I mean, I think that's a low blow to gain sympathy votes. That's unfair, I think. But seriously, good for you, Yoni. Congratulations. I also heard, and it seemed to be a concern, that these people exercised for a year, lost 3.5 pounds, improved cardiorespiratory fitness, improved lean muscle mass, decrease comorbidities, and somehow that was a bad thing. I think it's only a bad thing when you appreciate that the obesity mafia somehow propagates the notion that clinically significant weight loss has to be 5 to 10%. So, of course, being part of that mafia, my respected opponent would say, well, look, that was only 2%. That's not good. How many of you here, rhetorically, would love to see at the end of 1 year that someone engaged in physical activity decreased 3.5 pounds, which is probably 4 or 5 kilograms of body fat, decreased waist circumference? The reason you have more body fat is you've improved skeletal muscle and you improve cardiorespiratory fitness. Ladies and gentlemen, I submit to you, if we had that as an outcome, we would see in our time the prevalence of obesity actually go down. So while I agree with Yoni's observation, I firmly disagree with the interpretation that somehow that's not positive. That's extraordinarily positive. So I think the notion of clinically significant weight loss. The other thing that I think I heard, and perhaps my colleague will correct me, that the people that were exercising, it wasn't only because they exercised that they did well. They ate better. The more you exercise, the better you ate. Well, I'm going to have to rearrange my slide now that shows all those perfect things and show that eating better is another outcome of exercising more. So again, I was somewhat confused by my opponent because there was no data shown. There was an egregious attempt to gain sympathy votes. And he seemed to be saying that exercise was really good for you. But seriously, I think one of the points that, of course, Yoni made is that the data that I showed you, and now I start my 3 or 4 minute summary, the data that I showed you were the results of efficacy studies. We needed to do that because there was too many people in the world at the beginning saying exercise doesn't work, it's not a good strategy, give it up totally. When you're thinking about managing obesity, just don't think about exercise. I think we've turned that corner, absolutely, and yes, We showed you efficacy results that come from laboratory studies, perfect conditions, ideal situations. We had to do that because that sets the stage for the effectiveness study. I will firmly disagree with my colleague and say that that he's concerned about exercise. We don't have enough effectiveness studies. We get no funding. The nutrition mafia, in terms of CIHR funding, outdoes the physical activity 20 to 1, 30 to 1. In terms of dollars. Try and get money to do a good randomized controlled trial with exercise as your treatment strategy when you go to the RCT committee and you're up against all the pharmacology boys. That's really tough. So I would disagree there. We need more. And it is true, absolutely true, what Yoni implies, that it's one thing to get people to adopt a healthy lifestyle. And all of you in here know it's quite another to get someone to sustain that lifestyle. We have much to learn there. And there's no question, if you want to reduce weight quick, calorically restrict. You do that. And when you do that, we will see a profound increase in our obesity epidemic because you cannot sustain that either, and that's what the nutrition mafia failed to say. See how much easier it is. Look, you had to exercise 600 calories a day. Yes, that was an artificial condition, right? The guidelines say do accumulate it over the day. You don't have to do it in one time. We did it in one time because of the nature of an efficacy trial. So the truth of the matter is I have no wisdom to share with you on how we're going to reduce obesity prevalence. Most of us believe that if we adopt physical activity combined with a healthy lifestyle, if we just maintain, if we stop the bleeding in my lifetime as a researcher, we will have done good. Because of the truth of the matter is, there is no diet on planet Earth. And the last time I went to Chapters with my daughters, there was 262 diet books, all of them claiming that caloric restriction, you can lose weight. There's no doubt about that. And all of them weigh more within 12 months of starting. Exercise, not the same. You just don't get that rapid decrease. The truth of the matter is, I showed you this, and Yoni made reference to this, and of course I saved this for my rebuttal. There's not a study that we've reviewed that use exercise that wasn't combined with a healthful diet. It's just that, as my dietitian colleagues, they've come to hate the word diet. Because diet means you reduce calories. It doesn't mean that you're necessarily eating better. So all of the people in our studies were eating better, and we know well that eating well is a cornerstone of obesity reduction, and I'm certain that Yoni and I agree with that 100%. I will say, though, with these, and I think my opponent referred to this, we've made a big deal over the years of trying to say that weight loss should not be the primary outcome of a study. Now, I know that that seems somewhat paradoxical, because if weight goes up, obesity goes up, so weight should go down if obesity is going to go down. That's the prevailing wind, certainly, amongst many Canadian researchers. But that's just simply not true, and that's what these studies have shown. And we've written much and speak as loudly as we can that obesity is not a behavior. Obesity is an outcome. And I think Yoni was implying somewhat similar. We've been trying to say that. It won't be the first time that we do that in healthcare. So yes, if someone is engaging in exercise and they don't lose weight, there might only be a 2-centimeter reduction in waist with an improvement in cardiorespiratory fitness and insulin. Give that person a hug. Embrace them. Tell them they've done good. They've succeeded in adopting the behaviors that on planet Earth are the best that we know of. We have no pharmacological evidence that says you could do better than behavior change. So we know behavior change is tough. So do away with the scale as the only indicator of success, and we will go, I think, a lot further than we are now. So I do believe, clearly, it's about lifestyle. If you think you can exercise and eat anything you want, you are clearly a foolish individual. Clearly foolish. I honestly believe that one day we will have in Canada healthy eating guidelines in concert with our physical activity guidelines, because that's the public health message. You can't do one without the other and gain the benefit of lifestyle. You will gain benefit of either, to be sure. But this, the reverse is also true. If you think you can follow the guideline and not be active and get the benefit, you are also equally foolish. So we do have to, in the end, focus on the behaviors. And that's been our biblical message for the last 20 years. I don't know why we have focused on the weigh scale as the only indicator of success. And I would submit of either well-balanced dietary-induced obesity reduction or exercise, or hopefully, of course, the both. I don't know why we do that in Canada, but we do. We do all the time. How many programs we have in Canada that we call healthy weights? Weighty Matters. We do that, all kidding aside, because that's what the public wants. Show me how to lose weight. That's what I want now. I don't care about the behaviors. And it goes totally against what we've done in the past. Yoni certainly, as a physician, knows that focusing on behaviors is not new. Right? 30, 40 years ago, where we had lung disease and lung cancer and cardiovascular disease was rampant, what was the very first thing that the CMA got together and did? I think it was the first thing. I wasn't there, but I suppose it was. Right? What did they do? They said, if we're going to do something about cardiovascular lung disease that is going on, we've got to focus on the behaviors. Can you imagine going into your doctor's office and saying, can you please manage my lung, weigh my lung disease today? That's not going to happen. What do I mean with that absurd observation? We do that with obesity, do we not? Let me measure your weight today. You send them out from your practice, out, you come back. What do you first say to them if the weigh scale does not give you what you had hoped? Oh, you panic. I'm generalizing now, right? And I know I'm editorializing, and I know I speak about this passionately, and I know I sing to the choir, but Canadians, Canada doesn't get it. We don't. And we fail, and we see the prevalence coming up because of some of the things that were even said here today. We thought that was a fair. We're afraid of exercise studies that don't lose weight. Rubbish. Embrace them if they're exercising. Did you measure the behaviors? We know that cardiorespiratory fitness and that eating better are the two behaviors that cause obesity. We did for smoking. We did that. We looked at the behaviors. I know it's more complex for obesity. It's far more complex than it is for smoking. I understand that. But we don't do it. We don't do it enough in Canada, and we have to do it. And we can't say that being physically active and consuming a healthful diet is somehow, in the end, going to scare Canadians. What that tells us is you and I, we haven't done our job. We're not focusing on the causal behavior. So by way of summary, this is my last, second to last slide. By way of summary, I say there's three strategies. And the strategies that I have mentioned here all, of course, will reduce risk. And I clearly know that if you improve lifestyle and there's no change in these, the residual risk is probably greater than this. I don't have randomized trials. I'm not going to see those trials in my lifetime. But that's not the point. You can't get here unless you start here. You cannot. But as soon as there's no weight change, if we discontinue the behaviors, as the implication was, then we've done harm. How many of us in our practices measure cardiorespiratory fitness as a fundamental aspect of what we do? Measure, not self-report. Right? Measure it. So that we can tell people you are engaging in the behaviors. Until we start doing that, will we be back? We'll have the same debate. Is it exercise or it's diet? You know the only difference? That childhood obesity won't have gone up 700%. It'll be 900% because we don't get it. The childhood school programs? No, I would agree with Yoni. I think I heard this implication. Why do we care about obesity? If we get them physically active, eating better, that'll take care of itself. That'll take care of itself. So I agree that the outcome, again, should not drive the behaviors. So in the interest of fair play, given the egregious attempt by my respected opponent to gain the sympathy vote, right? We're done. Now, this is my wife's dog. Could be with her now and my dog, but I'm not. I chose to come here, even though I believe it's his 6th anniversary. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Ross, and we'll just have a few final wrap-up comments from Dr. Friedhoff.
Thanks. Thanks, Bob. So I have to take issue with something that Bob said, because he presumed something about what I might think or say that's not actually true. I've got to also try and figure out how to start down at the bottom of my talk rather than at the beginning of my talk. I don't know if anybody here knows how to do that. Maybe I just won't use the big screen. In terms of where I have to correct him, I actually think that the outcomes in terms of people exercising and losing 3 pounds are wonderful. You know, some of you may know that I wrote a book with Dr. Sharma where we rage against the notion of using body mass indices or weights to suggest someone has or has not succeeded. That's not what it's about. It's about living the healthiest life a person can enjoy. You know, it's about eating the healthiest diet you can live with for the rest of your life, not the healthiest one you can tolerate for a few weeks, which is a diet. But similarly, in regard to exercise, it is about exercising as much as you can enjoy doing. I think that when it comes to weight management, people have a very bad habit of falling into the under-eating, over-exercising trap, where that one of those two or a combination of those two approaches are what's adopted, and then people fail. And I think that some of the blame definitely falls on the shoulders of the messaging that we give people in regard to weight in society. And I think that that messaging in part comes from researchers too. You know, I understand this is about, like Bob said, if you're a hammer, everything's a nail, and I get that. But, you know, I really think that we need to think about the implications of what we're doing. In regard to exercise, I think we need to promote it more. I agree with Bob. In terms of research, sure, if it will help inspire people to do more, we need to fund it more, but I think that doing the research under the banner of it causing weight loss probably isn't the wisest plan. And I think, maybe I'm wrong, but I think Bob would agree. I think the wiser plan is to approach exercise for the benefits of exercise to health. We're forgetting that. More importantly, though, society doesn't know that. Not at all. And I guess the reason why, perhaps, can be explored from this study. So we talked about this study briefly. This was the 5,000 Dutch adults. I'm just going to try to go through this manually. They were monitored for 10 years. They were measured 10 years in a baseline, whether or not exercise mattered. And like I told you, that there was, in fact, a difference at 5 years, but that it did not persist at 10. And that really, ultimately, at the end of the day, exercise did impact weight very much. But what were the conclusions in the study drawn by the authors with those results? These findings support the need for public health programs that promote physical activity. This study didn't look at the outcomes Bob was talking about, where I think they might well have concluded this quite rightly in terms of increased benefits to cardiorespiratory fitness, insulin, and so forth. This study was making this conclusion on the basis of a 10-year look and a 1.2-pound difference in weight and a 1/5 of an inch difference in waist. Now, again, having somebody not gain for 10 years or lose a pound in 10 years is phenomenal. People are gaining weight 1 to 2 pounds a year. So this, in fact, is a huge success. But I think that the messaging matters so dramatically to everybody out there. Because I'll tell you from my personal experience with literally thousands of patients at the bedside right now, it is far easier to help people affect a change in dietary consumption of calories than to get them regularly exercising in any dramatic amount as far as weight goes. But the fact is, we cannot ignore the fact that what people want is weight management. I don't think that that's necessarily the right thing for people to want, but you're not going to be able to start, I don't think, many programs that are run specifically on the basis of the improvements in cardiorespiratory fitness when we continually tell the public that obesity is going to be treated effectively through exercise in the real world. And so if there's one message where I want to bring things home, it's that one. In terms of presenting data, Bob presented some nice data on food's impact on weight control. He showed those nice bar graphs. I didn't think there was a great deal of need for that because this talk here was to talk about, in my mind, exercise and how we package it. And so ultimately, I would love to see Bob get more research funding. I would love to see exercise protected as something we need to do. But I would also love to see us stop talking about it in terms of obesity, especially if we're not going to, at least as vigorously, in the same breath, talk about food. Thank you.
You've been listening to Forks vs. Feet, a debate at the University of Ottawa in May of this year between Dr. Bob Ross from Queen's University and Dr. Yoni Friedhoff from the Bariatric Medical Institute in Ottawa. So thanks to everyone for listening. As usual, you can comment on this podcast and other topics at the blog, which can be found at blogs.plos.org/obesitypanacea, or just Google Obesity Panacea, and that should bring you to us. Also, remember, you can subscribe in iTunes, and if you do subscribe, we would really appreciate it if you would leave us a rating. That would be very helpful to us. So thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.